Hello, and welcome to Within the Musician podcast. This podcast is a place of discovery for all students, performers, educators, and future educators. I'm your host, Monica Williams. I'm a flutist, teaching artist, recording artist, performer, composer, and lifelong learner. I'm super excited to bring our guest to the show today. Her name is Toni Oswegan, and she is a musician in her early years, but she comes to us with the expertise of mental health. She's a licensed mental health counselor. Today, we're going to talk about some topics near and dear to my heart. We're going to talk about this holiday season that we're all in and how it's more challenging this year without performances. As musicians, I feel performances are part of our musical identity, and Toni has lots of great insights about how we can think about this and manage this holiday season. Other things we're going to talk about are things like performance anxiety and imposter syndrome and perfectionism, all great topics for the mindset needed to really be successful as musicians. I want to say we delved into a lot of topics and we just barely scraped the top surface. Toni has an amazing podcast series of her own called Toni Talks Therapy. So if you are interested in any of these topics, head on over to her podcast, and she has full episodes on every single one of these topics that we pretty much are going to get into. So it's my pleasure to welcome Toni Oswegan. Welcome, Toni.
Hi, Monica. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks so much for being here. We were just saying that I have never met you in person, but I follow your Instagram and I love your podcast. So I'm so happy that you took some time to come over to our podcast and chat with us a little bit today.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here.
Can you start off by telling us just a little bit about yourself, where you are, what your specialties are for those who don't know you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a licensed mental health counselor based in Seattle, Washington, and I run a group therapy practice called Riverbank Therapy, where, you know, I have some therapists working in the practice, and then I also see clients individually in the practice. And I'm primarily what I call myself is a somatic trauma and attachment therapist. So I focus on the way that our childhood and our life experience and traumatic events, how they land in our body, how our bodies carry that, those experiences, and how we can connect with our bodies and heal through the body, through movement, through awareness. And I'm on Instagram at Toni Talks Therapy. So on there, I talk about all kinds of mental health stuff, emotional awareness, somatic awareness, trauma, depression, anxiety, sort of all the things. Podcast of the same name, Toni Talks Therapy. And I'm actually sort of loving hearing that you play the flute. I grew up playing piano since I was like 8 and started playing flute in the 6th or 7th grade. And
oh, cool.
I haven't played in a long time, but now I'm like, man, I want to go pick up my flute and see if I still remember everything.
It's never too late. Actually, I have an adult flute choir, and a lot of people come to it after raising kids and they're like, you know, I need to get back to music. So it's so fun to work. So yes, you can always bring it back. Mm-hmm. You know, as I look at your Instagram post and listen to your podcast, I am always thinking how this applies to me, but also other musicians. The idea of mindsets to be a successful musician is really important, just as much as the practice part that we do, how we come to think of ourselves and our experiences. And at times, being a musician can be a stressful career path, especially right now in month 10 of the pandemic. We are in holiday season. So holidays, musicians tend to be very busy. It's one of our busiest time of the year of all ages, students doing concerts, mm-hmm. to professionals doing professional events, corporate events. And this year is, of course, different for everyone. But musicians are feeling at least from what I've seen, a sense of lack. And I think that can affect mental health. And, you know, I've seen posts that are a little bit more on the depression spectrum and talking about sadness and loneliness and sense of self-worth. How can musicians kind of shape this to make ourselves through this next 30 days and into the new year? Is there any suggestions for depression? Can you speak to that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. I think the word that comes to mind, I think for 2020 in general, but as I hear you talk about the experience of musicians during this time, like grief is the word that comes to mind, right? There's so much that we have lost this year. Not, you know, all of the lives of people who have actually died from COVID, but also loss of important events, loss of, you know, the expectation of certainty, loss of consistency, loss of income. I'm sure a lot of musicians might be experiencing that right now too. And so sort of the first thing that comes to mind is just acknowledging and validating the pain of all of these various losses. That when we say, I shouldn't be feeling sad or I shouldn't be feeling depressed about this, that we are adding a layer of suffering on top of the pain that we're already feeling. And so by letting ourselves, you know, allowing ourselves to feel what we feel and saying, this is okay and this makes sense to feel this way, that just lifts some of the weight of what we're already carrying.
That's a good point, because I see a lot, and I do this myself, like, you know, at least I'm not off this bad, or at least it's not this bad. We kind of like try to qualify it that, you know, and which, I mean, I guess is another way of reframing it. But on the other hand, it's kind of denying that grief process that you speak of.
Exactly. And I think too, you know, what I hear and what you just said is like, oh, well, at least I don't have it as bad. You know, I think sometimes that practice of gratitude can be really valuable. You know, oh, I still have an income, or I can still do this performance in this way, or I can still access my holiday experience like this, right? I think that gratitude can be helpful. And if we're trying to force it, or if we're doing that gratitude before we validate the hurt that we're feeling, then it can feel really painful and sort of invalidating and icky. So I always jump to like, can we validate the emotion first? And then move anything else that might be helpful.
That's so gratitude is, it kind of comes in kind of an order of things, as if I understand this right. So you want to make sure that you can be grateful, but first after feeling what your loss and your grief process is. Yeah. That makes sense. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, because that to me, that like act of compare, you know, I think gratitude can often be used as an act of comparison. You know, I don't have it as bad as this person over here. And it's like, okay, hold on, but something's still hurting for you. And the fact that that person's hurting over there differently doesn't impact the fact that you're hurting like this right now. And so can we validate the hurt you're feeling now? And then maybe be grateful that it's not something else, right?
And for a lot of people, it's not only just a different type of experience this year with the lack of music opportunities, but I think, you know, music is also kind of an identity. It can almost feel like you've lost some of your identity when all of a sudden for the last, especially people that are in Broadway, dancers, that they haven't, it's hard to do that virtually. You know, there's been great virtual performances, but it's not the same as, you know, going to a Broadway show and going to an orchestra concert, all those things that people do more of during this time of year. So it can also be like a lack of identity. What would you say to those musicians feeling kind of like they've lost their identity? Is that also a grief factor?
Absolutely. Yeah. Of like that we carry around these ideas of who we are, right? And often it is our profession or the things that we do. You know, I am a musician. I, you know, Tony, am a therapist. If I couldn't do therapy, I would be super lost. I mean, I'm feeling a little lost even just switching from in-person therapy to virtual therapy. But that certainly is like another layer of this grief and loss is, you know, who I thought I was is now very different. Because I can't do the things that I have been doing, these things that I value, that bring me fulfillment, that contribute to my sense of maybe even purpose in life. Right? And so I do think that's absolutely another layer of grief here.
And feeling lost. I mean, that's something that's like probably a good word, because lost is something that I think a lot of artists are feeling. You know, first of all, you have to like figure out a way to stabilize yourself and financially in order to like just live. But then it's a reevaluation. When is this going to get better? The uncertainty of this is like a huge, huge weight. Is it going to be, are we going to go back in January? Is it going to be February? Is it going to be March? You know, are we going to go back? You know, that type of thing. Is my organization, is my orchestra going to be able to financially make it? So there's all this uncertainty and a lot of the stuff that probably most of us can't control. But, you know, I think that, you know, at least for me, you can think about your immediate surroundings of what you can control here, you know, and hopefully you may not have a clear picture of what it's going to look like in 2021. But how would you speak to that? How does someone stabilize themselves if they're really feeling lost?
Yeah. I love that you speak to that sense of uncertainty. I think that is one of the biggest ongoing stressors. I mean, there are, you know, like COVID and financial worries and all the things that we are stressed about this year. And to me, the through line of all of those things is uncertainty. I don't know what I'm going to be doing in 6 months. I don't know how I'm going to come up with rent next month. I don't know if my job's even going to exist or the place where I work is even going to exist when we're able to go back to something like normal, right? That sense of uncertainty. And I forget where I read this. I'll see if I can source it as I continue to talk. Mm-hmm. But there's some therapist or psychologist who talks about uncertainty as one of our most fundamental fears. That it is one of the scariest things we can experience in a human life is something like uncertainty. And so that sense of the ground that I'm standing on is uncertain. I don't know if I'm going to keep being able to stand here. And so to me, stabilizing through that uncertainty is one, again, validation, right? This is scary. This is hard. This hurts. Being really kind to yourself with whatever emotions are rolling through. And then, like you said, I think really focusing on what are the things that I do have some control over. There's a lot of things that are out of my control, and I have control over what time I wake up in the morning. I have control over whether or not I feed myself today. I have control over, you know, whether or not I open up in this relationship, right? If I am close to the people around me. And I think that sort of narrowing of our focus onto the things that we do have say over is really grounding, can be really empowering, and sort of helps us focus on what is my next step rather than what is my 10th step from now.
Yeah. That makes a lot. So like just kind of making a list of priorities of what I need to do just to get through the day, what I need to get through the week. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Because I think a lot of us are thinking really big. How am I going to, like, you know, make 2021 work or, you know, but it's really a day-to-day.
Exactly. Yeah. How can I make today work? How can I make next month work? You know, even if next month is a framework that works, you know, maybe it's today, maybe it's next week, maybe it's the next 5 minutes, right? Mm-hmm. We are in an ongoing traumatic situation and survival is enough, right? Survival is enough.
Right.
We don't have to make a 5-year plan right now. Mm. I don't think any of us could even imagine a 5-year plan right now. Yes. Like, it's okay to slow down and just plan for today.
Right. Yeah. And the holidays, you know, in a normal year, not in a 2020 year, are hard for a lot of people just because they tend to be hard on a lot of people. Let's talk about therapy. I love this therapy is cool type of slogan that's going around on Instagram. I myself am in therapy, and I tell my students I've been very open that I'm in therapy, and it's been life changing for me. Awesome. Can you tell us just a little bit about like the therapy process? Who should go to therapy? Who is therapy for? Do I need to be in a crisis to go to therapy?
Yeah, I love this question. To me, therapy is for everyone, and not everybody needs therapy all the time. And not everybody wants therapy, right? But I think that everybody does, like, quote unquote, qualify for therapy. If you're a human, you qualify. And I think especially this year, therapy can be a really valuable space to talk through the uncertainty, to feel through all of the emotion, the roller coaster of emotions that are living in 2020. And we don't have to have a crisis. We don't have to even have a diagnosis to go to therapy. If you're planning on billing insurance, we do have to put diagnoses on there to get reimbursed by insurance. But a lot of therapists don't work with insurance. You can get sliding scale or paying out of pocket. There's a lot of reduced rate options for therapy that don't require diagnoses. And so we don't even need to have, you know, a condition to go to therapy. I think being in the human condition is enough. And therapy's like, I've been in therapy off and on since I was like 14. And actually just recently got back in therapy about 6 months ago, when I lost my mom. And it really is this really beautiful process of getting to know yourself through a relationship with another person. You build a relationship with your therapist, and it sort of holds up this mirror to who am I and what do I need and how do I care for myself and access care with the people in my life.
And I like that you say you don't have to qualify for therapy. I think that's what held me back for a lot of time. I did go to therapy earlier, you know, but just briefly. But, you know, I'm not that depressed. I'm not that anxious. I'm not that this. And therefore, you know, you wait until maybe you really need it. But, you know, you should probably go before that happens. You know, that's my life lesson of that. And there's so many layers, and it is so beneficial to have that space in order to help you process and figure out what you want. Because a lot of musicians, I think, are going to, you know, hopefully reimagine what their life creatively looks like. And that's not always a bad thing, I don't think. You know, I think 2020 has challenged us in some good ways as artists as well, but it's not easy to completely reimagine yourself for all artists, especially those who have a large part of their percentage in the actual performing aspects of it. But I like that you say it's for everyone. So I just wanted to put that out there, because if anyone is thinking about therapy and thinking they don't have enough of a problem, you know, you don't need that, which is something I hadn't heard before. I mean, there is this stigma about like going to therapy, like, oh, you should. And I've experienced that too. And you know, people say that when I just mention it casually, it's almost as if there's like something wrong, like, oh, I'm so sorry, you know, versus like, that therapy is cool, you know, like,
I would love for the cultural response to I'm in therapy instead of, oh, I'm sorry, or some sort of judgment, to be like, congratulations, you're doing the really hard work that a lot of people don't ever do of taking a hard look at yourself. Right. And getting in really close relationship with yourself. And it's a really, I think, brave and rewarding thing to do. And like you said, we don't have to, I have a lot of clients who have come to therapy and they're like, I just kind of want to know what this is like. I don't even really know what I want. I just think therapy could be helpful. Can you help me figure out how it might even be helpful? Right? Like, some people don't even come to therapy with an idea in mind of what they need. They're just like, I need a place to talk, and I think this might be it. And then along the way, we can work together and figure out, you know, oh, you're feeling, you know, lost over here. You need to reimagine your career. Let's talk through that and figure out what that looks like for you. And so there's a lot of different places therapy can go. It's not just, I have depression, please help me be less depressed. It can be so many different things.
I think that's helpful. It's certainly helpful for me. Hopefully helpful to some other people and musicians. So another thing I wanted to talk to you about was just the concept of stress and anxiety. And you had a great podcast on this. And so I had a question for you on this. As a teacher, as an educator, one of the biggest questions I get is, how do I handle performance anxiety? And that's a big topic. It's a huge topic for musicians. Take beta blockers to help with performance anxiety. Like, and no one really talks about it. It's like, you know, but it's a thing, because there's stress. And of course, you want to do well as a musician. But I wanted to talk to the fact about, like, good stress. I know you mentioned on your podcast that there was good stress. Can you tell us about good stress and how that might be helpful to a musician?
Absolutely. Yeah, I believe it's called the Yerkes-Dodson curve. I might be wrong on that. But there was this study at some point, I'm not great at sourcing years, that basically said that if we are not stressed at all, then our nervous system isn't quite activated enough to get us to do the thing we need to do. But if we are too stressed, the same thing happens. Our nervous system is too activated to get us to do what we need to do, right? Mm-hmm. Which I'm sure we've all experienced in performance anxieties. Like my hands are shaking and I just like can't go on stage, right? Mm-hmm. And so there is this middle ground of good stress where I am just stressed enough to know that I need to prepare. I am just stressed enough to maybe feel even some excitement about this, or I'm just stressed enough to sharpen my mind. You know, there is an aspect of stress where all of our senses sharpen and we get some clarity of mind before it tips into not useful stress. And that can really be a helpful thing, right? And so I don't know that the goal is no stress at all. Mm-hmm. That might happen for some people. And I don't think that's a bad thing. If we're not stressed performing, then like, great. Mm-hmm. Please teach us all your secrets. Mm-hmm. But for some of us, we can just bring stress down a little bit. So it is in that sort of useful sliver. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Yes. And okay. You know, that kind of summarizes what I've been trying to explain to a lot of students is that, you know, it's okay to be nervous, that nerves are good. It can heighten that alertness, and you care. It shows that you care about something, because if you didn't care about it, you wouldn't necessarily be nervous. So, that's, it can be a good thing. And I think that just knowing that is helpful for musicians, especially young musicians going in, that just because I'm nervous doesn't mean I'm going to do bad. It doesn't mean that, you know, that this is going to be a bad performance, or you're actually fearing being nervous. Cause I think it can snowball. Like I'm nervous, and now I'm nervous about being nervous, and now I'm more nervous about being more nervous and what this is going to cause. And it's just, you can cycle about it. Instead of I'm nervous because I care, I'm excited, and this is going to be a great performance. Mm-hmm. Easier said than done, but I know that that's definitely a thing. So
And that's such a piece of, I think, of emotional work, is when we feel our feelings without judging them, they have a far shorter time period, right? If we feel anxiety and don't judge it at all, it's going to peak and then it's going to pass. Mm-hmm. Right. But if we feel anxiety and then we get anxious about feeling anxious, then we're going to feel anxious for the next 3 hours, because we're now telling ourselves this really big story about what the anxiety means about us and what it means for the performance and all these things. But if it's just like, oh, I'm anxious, anxiety is normal right before a performance.
Right.
Now you can go on and do what you got to do and you're fine. Mm-hmm. Right?
And that sometimes I think that just being a little bit nervous or being in that state can bring, you know, because there is an emotional, music is kind of a communication. So there is an element of connecting to your audience. I worry about not judging people that take beta blockers, but, you know, when I personally took them, I think that it can block that a little bit, like, because it's blocking other things. Just because you shake a little less on beta blockers doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, that that's still a better performance, you know? So it's something that I think every individual musician has to evaluate for themselves and pick which is the best path. But that's just to not be afraid of nerves. And that's one thing that I've been really working with my students. I think it's that fear, like you said. Which brings me to the next topic, is perfectionism in musicians. So, I mean, and you had a whole podcast on this, and I'm kind of like, if anyone is interested in this, Tony has like all of these topics that I'm kind of cramming through. Tony has like a whole episode on each one. So if this is interesting to you, definitely head over to her podcast, which I'll put in the program episode notes. But you had a whole episode about perfectionism. And as I listened to that, I'm like, you know, this so relates to musicians, because I think a lot of us are perfectionist by just nature of getting into the field. I'm making it really general. I'm speaking for myself. Maybe I should speak for myself. But is there a good or bad to perfectionism? Can you speak to like the good points and maybe some of the points that are not quite as good?
Yeah. I think similar to stress, perfectionism can be something that in small doses can be useful, right? Perfectionism encourages you to practice. It encourages you to work hard at your craft because you want to be good, right? And so in some sense, it's not necessarily a bad thing. And a lot of the time, perfectionism becomes linked to our self-worth. It becomes linked to our concept of who we are and what we deserve. And so if perfectionism is saying, if I don't get this piece of music perfect, then I'm a terrible musician. Then I don't even deserve to be on stage and nobody should even listen to me. If I can't get it perfect, then I can't perform, right? That is the sort of perfectionism that might paralyze you, right? It might keep you from engaging with your craft because now, well, shit, I can't even start because it's not going to be good enough, right? Or on the other hand, it might be you're practicing, you know, 10 hours a day and you're exhausted and you haven't eaten enough and you haven't cared for your relationships or your body, right? And like, okay, now perfectionism is driving you to overwork and to wear yourself out. And so if we can find that middle ground of, I want this to be really, really good. And it matters to me that it's really good and it's not going to be perfect. And that's okay. Yeah. I'm still good enough. I'm still good at what I do, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's sort of the sweet spot we want to land in.
You bring up a point. I mean, I remember in college, and I was just talking to Aaron Goldman, who was on the first show. We were in college together, and it almost was a thing, like how much you practiced in the practice room was your self-worth. Like, you know, I practiced 8 hours today. Yeah. I practiced 9 hours today, as if that qualified you as a better musician. It was almost fear of failure. I think that's to me, the downside of perfectionism. There are some good points to it, but there, you know, that's to me a downside of that. Yeah, and as kids coming into this, because a lot of musicians, of course, teach this, you know, I think classical musicians, you've played flute, you probably remember this, that, you know, we're one of the only subjects in school that they actually place you in first, second, third, and fourth, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
so stressful.
And it would be like, if you did that in a math class, I mean, you would be fired. But in music, that's standard, you know? And so I think it, you know, as musicians, we kind of get, I'm speaking especially to the classical musicians in there, that we kind of are already put in a perfectionism type of a mentality because, you know, you're being judged so much on the details and not as much on your craft at the very beginning, like, you know, your musicality. It's the fear of making a mistake. The other day in a lesson, I had a 7th grader say, "I'm sorry," 21 times during 3 minutes. I actually counted it. And, you know, I pointed that out to her, but, you know, I did it myself. I'm like, let's talk about what you're saying you're sorry for. And it came down to, I'm sorry for making a mistake. And, you know, and while that she's young, I think that we all, you know, we kind of grew up with that. So when we're now adults and performing musicians, and that's still there, that I'm sorry, or the fear of failure. So
absolutely.
So that's something I'm coming to realize a lot in myself and my students, is that sweet spot that you talk about. Where is that sweet spot that we can find that works for every individual? So absolutely. I was really interested by that topic. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And a thought that just came up as you were talking about, you know, like first chair, second chair, which I'm just like flashback to my high school band days.
Sorry for the trauma.
But I think about, you know, like, why are we doing this, right? Am I doing this so I can quote unquote win, right? So I can get first chair. Is that my whole reason for playing music, right? No. You do this because you love it. You do it because you love making beautiful sound with other humans, and it's amazing and magical, right? And I think part of that perfectionism is trained into us by society, is if you're not first chair, you're a loser and you suck. Like, that's so much the narrative that we're handed. And it's not true. And maybe that's not the most important thing. And so I think that, like, that connection back to purpose, why do I do this? What's fulfilling about this to me can help sort of fight through both the perfectionism and that comparison that we so often do. Like, it's okay if I'm fifth chair. I really like playing. Really enjoy it.
Right. And that's a much healthier way to look at it. I also tell my students that no one has ever asked me what chair I was in middle school, high school, or college. Never ever gotten that question as a musician. Yep. So although we put a lot of stock in it in the beginning, it's not really the important element.
Exactly.
The other thing I wanted to mention is, this is a new word for me. I didn't learn this word, ironically, until just a couple of years ago, imposter syndrome. Can you tell us what it is and how to get over it? Yes.
Yeah. That's such a good question. We're going to solve it right now. To me, there's probably some sort of formal definition out there, but to me, imposter syndrome is the sense that I'm not as good as I think I am, and people are going to see through me. Mm-hmm. People are going to see that this is all a facade. Mm-hmm. None of this is real. They're going to see that I'm just faking it. Mm-hmm. And it's that sense that we don't deserve to be where we are, mm-hmm. or that other people are gonna find us out, mm-hmm. or judge us for being where we mm-hmm. are. And it is so common. Mm-hmm. I often tell people, like, literally all of us, I think, have experienced imposter mm-hmm. syndrome at some point, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. If we're all worried we're going to get found out, maybe that means we're already found out, that we're just like imperfect humans making it up as we go, mm-hmm. right? That's one of the reminders I give myself for imposter syndrome. And to me, it's really, really shame-based, mm-hmm. right? We have a success. We say, oh, I don't deserve this, right? That's at the core of imposter mm-hmm. syndrome. I didn't work hard enough. I just got, like you said, I just got lucky. Mm-hmm. People are going to see that I just got lucky and that I'm not actually all that talented, mm-hmm. right? Like, to me, that shame is at the middle of imposter syndrome.
Right.
And part of the way through it is, one, grounding in your actual skills, mm-hmm. right? I am good at this. I did work hard for this. I did plan and practice and do all the work to get to where mm-hmm. I am. Like, this wasn't happenstance. Mm-hmm. Right? So there is a reality to what you did to get where you are. And then the other piece, I think, is exactly what I was saying a minute ago, to realize that basically everybody feels this way. I'm remembering when this was probably about 5 years ago, I was working with the Washington State Board of Counselors, and the president of the association was sort of training me up in the organization. And we went to a meeting down in Olympia, the Washington State Capitol, to meet with the Department of Health for some rule making changes they were going to do for our profession. Mm-hmm. And on the way down, I was expressing some anxiety, you know, of, oh, there's all these big wigs in this room and they're making important decisions. And I remember the person I was driving with just said, like, they're all just normal people. There's nothing like, you know, special about them other than that they're in this titled role at the Department of Health. They're just people, mm-hmm. right? And so I constantly think about the Wizard of Oz, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. It's like, we're all the man behind mm-hmm. the curtain. We are all that little guy, like, trying to seem bigger than we are. Mm-hmm. And like, what if we all just know that and we let ourselves be the man behind the curtain? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope that makes sense.
It makes total sense. And I imagine that if you're in that state, I'm just like giving it. So say you've reached a certain position, you've reached the position in Broadway that you want to be in, and you're worried that, you know, you're going to be found out. I'm imagining it creates a lot of anxiety that goes with it, because now you have to be in fear of losing your job. It's, you know, it's not only self-doubt of yourself, but it's like fear of, like, oh, I'm going to be found out and lose my job. And so I think a lot of self-talk sounds like, and therapy, if you can do it, kind mm-hmm. of helps with that, mm-hmm. that's kind of imposter syndrome. But that was a word that I didn't know until, and then I realized that, yeah, it is probably very common. I think that.
And it's really wrapped up in anxiety. It's really wrapped up in perfectionism and comparison and all of these things we've been talking about, right? That sense that, like, oh, I don't deserve to be here. I'm an imposter. And so now I have to work extra hard so that I don't get found out. And like, oh, are you burning yourself out in the process of that? Mm-hmm. And can't only lean into what got you there in the first place.
Yeah, and these are big topics. I know these are big topics. Not for each one of these is an episode, but today I just wanted to make it a kind of a, like, a little dab into each mm-hmm. one of them. So the other thing I want to bring it back is to therapy again. And, you know, therapy, I consider it one of the best investments in myself that I've done. But let's face it, it's not always cheap for someone to get into therapy. And so first of all, let's talk about, like, if someone has the means, how do they find a therapist? How would one find a therapist mm-hmm. that could be a good fit if they decide they want to explore this?
Totally. One place you can start is asking your doctor for referrals. A lot of doctors have, you know, connections to therapists in the community. Ask your family and friends. Honestly, this is part of how I get a lot of referrals at this mm-hmm. point, is like old clients of mine refer to me their brother or whatever. And down the road after, you know, after I'm done working with that client, then maybe later on I can work with someone they know. But yeah, asking family and friends for referrals, a Google search, right? Or an Instagram search, right? You can search on social media for therapists in your area. And this is part of why I have a social media, is that people who want to work with me can sort of see what I think before they work with me. And a Google search, you know, therapists near me, and Psychology Today is probably going to be the first search result. And that's a big online directory of therapists in your area. And you can sort by, if you have insurance, what insurance company they're paneled with. You can search by gender, by presenting issue, by training, all of these things, and you can sort of narrow down. And what I tend to recommend is schedule, almost every therapist I know offers a free 10 to 30 minute consultation. And so you can get on the phone with them and talk, you know, here's a little bit about what's going on with me. Can you tell me about how you do this work, what therapy looks like, what your training is? So you can really get a sense for whether that person's a good fit for you. And then from there, you schedule your intake session, you do all your paperwork, and you sort of get going. And I typically also tell people to, if you found a good fit and you go to your first session and you're like, ooh, I'm not actually sure this is a good fit, if you are able to, give it another two or three sessions. Often it takes a couple of sessions to really start to feel like grounded in the relationship. I like to tell people to stick with it a little bit longer, unless it's like, oh no, this person makes me feel very unsafe, or like they said something really offensive to me, then like get out of there, go find someone else. Yeah, so that's sort of my recommendations around getting the process started. And I actually, I have a whole podcast episode on starting therapy. I think it's like an hour long that speaks to sort of questions you can ask therapists, ways to prepare for a first session. So there's, I'll just plug that specific episode. There's some more information in there too.
That's great. Those are great suggestions. And what if someone really can't afford therapy? I'll know that there's resources. What would you recommend? What are your favorite recommendations for someone that's, we'll just go with no insurance and can't afford it, but needs some help, needs some stabilization help.
So one option is Open Path Collective. This is an online directory for therapists that specifically are open to clients who are only able to pay, I think it's $30 to $60 a session is the reduced rate generally accepted on Open Path. So that's a really good option. Another option is any therapist offers most almost every therapist I know offers some reduced rate spots. And so if you find a therapist you really resonate with, you can email them and say like, hey, I lost my job because of COVID and I'm really struggling. I can do $5 a session. Is that something you might be open to? Some therapists are going to say no, but you never know. Another great option is to look into counseling schools in your area or teaching practices. So every counseling program has their students meet with clients under pretty intensive supervision, and those services are typically free or very cheap.
I think that's a great option.
And so if there's a school in your area, then contact that school and see if you can get into their training clinic or to work with one of their interns. And then there's also training practices. I have an intern in my practice right now, and we're offering sessions anywhere from $0 to $50 a session. And so that interns can be really, really great to work with. And he's in his last, year of his master's program. So he's well-trained. He's getting like 4 hours of supervision a week. And so often working with interns or students, you're actually getting more comprehensive care than you get with a clinician who is seeing 30 clients a week. So that's another really good option for people who have low funds.
Those are great suggestions. Yeah, I know there's one in San Francisco. I know there's a school in San Francisco. There's probably a ton if you do your research in the area. But there is, the point is that there are some options if you can't afford therapy. You have to work a little bit, dig around a little bit, but you can find a therapist that might be reduced or even free. And then, of course, there's the crisis line, right? When should someone call that? I mean, we're approaching holidays. I'm just thinking of that one listener that's like, you know, but I'm really depressed. I'm really struggling, but I don't think I'm bad enough to call the crisis line? What would you say to
those? The crisis line is a really great resource, like you said, for people who are feeling really depressed. It's geared towards people who are experiencing suicidal thoughts. And that can be, you know, gosh, I just wish I didn't wake up in the morning, right? It might be a thought like that. Or it might be, I'm planning to kill myself this day in this way, right? It might be a little bit more of an active thing. And so certainly if you're there, please call the crisis hotline. Please call someone. But those crisis lines can also be really useful for like, God, I'm just feeling so depressed because of COVID and I don't know what to do. Call the crisis line. They can talk you through it. They can give you some resources. They're supportive even for people who who aren't actively in that place of being in imminent danger.
Yeah. Right. And I had read that before. I didn't know that. So that you don't have to be in that imminent danger to actually call the crisis line. You know, that could be a first step to something that might be
helpful. And the crisis number, I feel the need to plug it now. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-TALK, which I think is 248. I can't remember the numbers for TALK on the dial pad. And then there's also a crisis text line in the US at least. And you can text HOME to 741741. And that's a crisis text line if you'd rather not be on the phone. That's a really good option. Yeah.
That is a good option. I think that a lot of people are more comfortable with the text type of a thing. I'll put those in the episode notes too, just in case. Those are very accessible in Google, but yeah, we'll put those in. And what if someone wants to work with you? Do you have openings right now, your practice? How could they contact you?
Yeah. So I personally do not have any openings for new clients right now, but I have an intern in my practice who's got openings, and I am probably next week at the time of this recording, at least, going to offer a position to another therapist who will probably start in January. And then we have another therapist who will be starting in our practice in mid to late February. And so we're sort of constantly adding therapists to our practice because we get a lot of new client inquiries right now. And so people can find me at Tony Talks Therapy on Instagram. And my practice website is riverbanktherapy.com. That's where people can read about our practice, insurance stuff, the various clinicians who work in the practice. That's riverbanktherapy.com.
Awesome. Yeah. Great. So that's sounds like you have a great practice there. And what amazing thing to have an intern that offers reduced rates.
Yeah, it's
been rad. that is great. Well, thank you so much for giving some of your time up. I think this was a great episode, and hopefully people will go over and learn more about each of these very topics that we just kind of dipped into just a teeny, teeny bit. So I'll put that in the program notes as well, Tony Talks Therapy, and both on Instagram and on Apple, Spotify, probably all the podcast platforms. But thank you so much, Tony. And I always, as I said, I love your Instagram, and they always have great insights, food for thought for the day. And I love that. So
awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Monica. This was a lot of fun.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you've enjoyed this show, I would be grateful if you could like, share, subscribe, or review if you're on Apple Podcasts. This will help us out in the algorithms and help us to reach more listeners so the podcast can be found more easily. Until next week, bye-bye.